afternoon and welcome to another episode of Read Me Something You Love. And you can probably hear the delirious excitement in my voice today because I am sitting not at a punch throw away. you'd have to probably punch through the gear to get to me.
Haymaker. A roundhouse.
Yeah, you could do it. I'm sitting a punch throw away from DW, Dave Wilson, one of my favourite short story writers of the moment. This is turning out to be a very, very good year for Canadian short stories and Canadian short story writers. Will Gaston, and this is a man who you know. He was one of your teachers, isn't that right?
Yeah, probably for about 3 years at UVic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did screenwriting with him, did a short story class with him, and did two novel workshops.
Wow. It is a fantastically accomplished story, and due to time constraints, we're going to take this fantastically accomplished story and butcher it somewhat.
Well, we're just going to... Abridge.
Well, I wonder if Biff would feel the same way about us taking and making some sort of editorial abridged judgment on his story. But
all we're doing is just skipping a little bit. That's it.
Okay. Well.
So that's all.
I'm hoping he's going to be okay with
it. I sort of ran it by him that I was doing this, and he kind of said, "Why?" And I was like, "Shut up, Biff."
Okay, well, let's hope we can at least do justice to the parts that we do read.
All right.
So let's read. So you've already introduced a little bit of the story. Is there anything else you need to sort of say before we begin? I don't think so, actually.
I think it'll more or less cover itself.
Great.
Okay. So this is Mount Appetite from Bill Gaston's short story collection, Mount Appetite. December 22nd. What were your instructions? Write your version down and send it to me. I'm grateful for this. I'm not good face to face, and today was a pressurized day. Sorry for raising my voice, etc. Here, I can craft my thoughts.
Can I just stop you? Sorry. Could you read it just a tiny bit slower?
Sure, yeah.
Just because, you know, it's fine. When you're listening.
I know.
And there's so much happening in that first
page. It's fine. And I do tend to read too fast. I know. I'm aware. Okay.
As slow as you can
take
it. Yeah.
So, December 22nd. What were your instructions? Write your version down and send it to me. I'm grateful for this. I'm not good face to face, and today was a pressurized day. Sorry for raising my voice, etc. Here, I can craft my thoughts before blurting, though I bet pushing the send button will feel like a blurt. You also said, be honest with yourself and with me. You said it as a challenge, but I heard it as an assessment. Well, all right. Being honest as possible, I'll start by saying that I find you rude. Sure, you were in a hurry, as doctors seem to be. True, I was on my way out the door, and true, I was yelling. But write your version down and send it to me is insulting. It says my version is a version. And my version of what? The events of that night? Simple. People came and dragged my daughter away. Or do you mean the event leading up to that night? Fine. How far back should I go? Felice is 12. Or are you asking how I came to administer controlled substances to a minor in my care? That is no less complicated. Plus, I resent your implication that if I don't follow through with this, I might not have your help in the investigation and all the other bureaucratic shit. Is honesty even possible here? Isn't it obvious that someone like me would say anything to get my daughter back? I'm out on my deck. It's 3 a.m, very crisp, and the sky offers grapey clusters of stars. My laptop battery light is blinking at me because it's never been this cold. But I want to tell you how helpless I feel, how I feel surrounded by galaxies of insane pettiness. Each galaxy, read, government ministry, is spinning in on itself with its mad, mad black hole in the middle, sucking in all common sense and decency and light. A black hole is the absence of a brain and, even more, a heart. The word ministry smacks of horror. It harkens back to when government was religion, a churchy time when ministry meant kindness. That it flipped to its soul-sucking opposite is, well, Orwell predicted it, didn't he? Having said all this, I do feel a bit lighter. I will try to be as honest as possible. I want nothing except to help Felice. December 23rd. Nothing you'll hear from me is completely true, even this sentence. That's a good one, isn't it? Or, everything you hear is only partly true, except for this sentence. There are some little cones I've been playing with in trying to tell you my version. I trust you got the first email. I do know I can't write everything down in one sitting. I get emotional and tired, and my mind breaks into voices shooting off on their own versions. Last night, I jumped up from this chair, voices coming off me like Medusa snakes. I had to leave for a good fast walk. I'll go to the heart of the problem. They think Felice has been damaged by my behavior, while in truth, it's her behavior that made me self-medicate in the first place. Please, I'm not blaming her. I'm saying it's no different than when any father comes home from work, gets stressed by his child, then gulps a scotch. In fact, I did use beer in this way some years back, but one beer led to six, and I was less than attentive dad. My switch to marijuana was a responsible act on my part. And if you can help them see the truth of this. But do you believe it's true? Who's the better father? The slurring lout on the couch watching breasty sitcoms, or the dad who is focused, gets involved, in fact, gets fascinated with her math homework, cooks fantastic meals, can drive her to her volleyball games, remains sensitive, even overly sensitive to her condition and her attacks. I think it's her condition that we're both interested in. It's what I most want to talk about. I've been wondering about how to do that, exactly. You're the professional. I've merely lived with her every day of her life. You understand my sarcasm. I don't care what you think about me, but if you believe me on just 3 points, I will be grateful. I can't let you agree with them that I am addicted to marijuana, which I am not, or that I grow marijuana with intent to traffic, which I do not. The second newspaper story used the term grow up, which is absurd. Or that I contributed to the delinquency of a minor by administering controlled substances, also untrue. The 3 points I need you to agree with. 1. I self-medicate because of her, but it's a responsible decision, without which I would have gone down the drain and taken her with me. 2. I've grown marijuana solely for medicinal use and sell it only to free up more time to spend with her. 3. My giving her marijuana in a deliberate and measured way is also a responsible act.
So, who's the better father? The slurring lout on the couch watching breasty sitcoms, or the dad who is focused, gets involved, in fact gets fascinated with her math homework, cooks fantastic meals, can drive her to her volleyball games, remains sensitive, even overly sensitive, because he is smoking marijuana and because he is giving her marijuana. I mean, to begin with, I don't know how you feel, but I sort of sense that as a reader, I have this kind of real moral dilemma. And in a way, I get this feeling that I have to kind of choose sides, almost.
See, I didn't get that when I first read this however many years ago. I think partly because it's set up to sympathize with the narrator, right? That he's obviously his version is the right version. He's in the right here. Although he even says that, you know, not everything I say is the truth. Or everything I say is only partially true, but it's funny that you say that because my girlfriend had a similar read of it where she wasn't sure whose side to be on, I wonder if that might just be the divide between the Atlantic there because you know, she's English and you're English and I'm Canadian and the narrator's Canadian. It has to do with just different views on it. I'm not sure, but it is. It is a very heavy and convoluted story, and it's offering a situation that it's a little bit uncomfortable, I think.
Yeah. Well, it is uncomfortable. I mean, you know, the first time I read it, it was like you start reading and you think, and you get to the point where you suddenly realize that this is a father who has been administering controlled substances to his daughter, and you kind of go, whoa! Which is sometimes also a feeling I get in your stories, that kind of whoa feeling, which is quite a thrilling place to be as a reader.
Yeah. It's. I mean, maybe I might just be skewed by it because I know Bill and because I read the story actually in my first year at university. My teacher, who wasn't Bill, gave us this story to read as for an assignment. But it is. I mean, I don't know. My woe might be different in that I didn't find it really shocking. But I wonder if that's also because I don't. Maybe I did find it shocking way back in 2004. And since having known what was coming, I wasn't shocked by it. But I do think that partly the way the narrator gives it to you makes you on his side, at least.
Well, I don't know. It's interesting you say on his side, because I'm not sure how sympathetic a narrator is. I mean, he does start, even in the first couple of pages, there is a kind of a real kind of associative manic quality to some of the stuff he's doing, you know, all the stuff about the galaxies and the government ministry, and that's not making him particularly sort of kind of, you know, sort of sympathetic.
Yeah. But it's cleverly done because the narrator isn't just, he's not a good guy, right? He's maybe the best guy we've got, right? But when he gets talking about Felice and how much he cares for her and the things he's done to try and help her, that's I think when the sympathy for him comes out the most. And so it's good that there isn't a good and a bad guy. Even the doctor narrator that you're given, who at first you get the narrator, you know, portrays him as the bad guy and as a dick, but I'm not sure that he is, right? You think he's probably just concerned about the situation. And yeah, I think I love it when fiction doesn't give you a good guy and a bad guy. It gives you I don't want to say shades of gray if I can help it. he gives you a sort of good guy and a sort of bad guy.
Yeah, and it gives you also somebody we can all identify with,
yeah,
which is
not perfect.
A blaming guy, because what he's doing is it's a lot of blame, isn't it? You know, I'll go to the heart of the problem. They think Felice has been damaged by my behavior, while in truth it's her behavior that made me self-medicate. You know,
it's sort
all
of
about blame.
Passes the buck a lot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true.
Which is what we all do when we're, you know, when our back is against the wall. Well, it wasn't me. Yeah. What do you think about that line? I just love that line where he says, right at the beginning, you know, you also said, be honest with yourself and with me. And I mean, that's a great line to have there, isn't there, in terms of that whole sort of reliable, unreliable narrator chestnut. And yet I feel he is being very, very honest, this man.
He certainly put himself, his neck on the block by even engaging in it. Right, with someone that he doesn't have any sort of like reason to trust, basically.
Yeah, and some of the things he's saying, he knows the doctor is, or he might presume the doctor would be potentially shocked by the fact that he's so sort of blasé about it, because he is quite he is intrinsically blasé, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, I think he also truly believes that he is doing the right thing, but he believes it too, right? So he doesn't think he's in the wrong, so far that he's willing just to say, this is what I did and it isn't wrong.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to say, well, actually, no, I didn't really do that. He's just saying, yes, I did, and it's not wrong, even though everyone else is saying, yes, it is.
Mm. Well, this sort of comes up in the next couple of pages, which we're not going to read, but
we're going to abridge.
This is where the abridging comes in. But I thought maybe a part that I would mention is when he just touches on, which we're going to go into more fully in the next piece, you know, why he needs to do this to Felice, and he talks about her even as a baby. This is on page 196, 197, he says, I recall Rose having the hardest time getting her to breastfeed, even when Felice was very, very hungry. The word hunger comes up there. A month old, with a milky nipple nudging her lips, Felice would thrash, wild-eyed, unable to decide what to do. I also remember her tantrums at age 2. In most ways, they resemble what still happens now. The frustration, the paralysis, the way it spikes in loud display, which you say you've seen, Doctor. So we have this child who is showing, I don't know what it would be called now, sort of ADHD-type tendencies, and he's decided to medicate her with marijuana. Now, of course, she could be medicated with all sorts of and, legal substances, and Ritalin, Prozac.
But it's also said that she has in the past been medicated with those, and that he has been unhappy with the result.
Yeah, and you were hinting just before that you think it's okay in inverted commas because, hey, you know, the doctor would give her Ritalin, so her father's giving her marijuana. That it's potentially okay for her father to be giving her marijuana. Is that your feeling?
Well, I think that the way that the narrator sets it up for us, it is the best decision he can give. Like it helps her, and that it produces results without potentially the side effect that at least the narrator is saying he doesn't like. Right? Like I don't remember where it is, but he describes like one of them even made her drool. You know, so it's these legal drugs she's been given. He also calls it the easy way out. That have just like reduced completely, like totally, like just blocked her personality and made her a bit of a like not able to make these decisions and not have these tantrums, but also not really be a person. And so he thinks, and I don't know. I mean, my gut is that he's doing the right thing, or he's doing the best thing, that giving her marijuana tea as he does leads her to be able to not have these tantrums, be able to make these decisions without all those side effects, and able to still kind of function.
Mm. Now, I'm just thinking what, you know, someone on the Daily Mail literary...
Oh, man.
Could you imagine the headline, you know?
We're talking, BBC
sort of
short story winner.
Short story winner.
Condones marijuana use. Well, that's okay, yeah.
But it is a really interesting moral quandary, because what is Ritalin? What is Prozac? Which we know five-year-olds are on.
Mm-hmm.
If not some sort of dampening drug, essentially.
Yeah, it just really is. It is a really good moral question, and asking it makes you take stock. I mean, I think probably I'm going to stick with saying that he's making the best decision. That way, I don't have to say right if I can help it. He's making the best decision he can given the situation. I'm going to stick with that one.
Yeah. I don't think the Daily Mail listens to this podcast, so we're okay there. let's read a bit more. So I thought maybe we could skip ahead to December the 26th, Boxing Day, where the boxing gloves kind of come off here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. So December 26th. Look, I don't know what to do. I'm settling in again to write. I should say something about what this is doing to me. Can you imagine what it's like to sit and write these things, knowing that the words I put here might or might not get me my daughter back? Do you understand that, between the words, I sometimes hyperventilate? Shouldn't I tell you this? I'll be dangerously honest with you and admit I've just had a smoke and my logic might be energetic, especially since this stuff is stronger than my homebrew. Shouldn't I tell you...
But I ask you just, seeing as you have had a smoke... If you could kind of go into, yeah.
Oh, you want me to?
No. You don't have to act. But
wait.
Just
also,
just
by the you don't mean me. We're not sitting here toking up in London Metropolitan University.
That would be a really interesting experiment if we actually got stoned and then.
Yeah, and then had our debate. We can do that round two.
Have a 7-hour podcast. If you could read just a tad slower.
All right, so...
Just in case the Daily Mail is listening in and that, you know,
right.
It might be a bit too fast for them.
Right, so from the Shouldn't I Tell You?
Shouldn't I Tell You, yeah.
Shouldn't I tell you that I feel pressured to be attractive to you? I'm trying to seduce you. How's that for honesty? I want you to think I'm decent, smart, honest, steady, responsible, when all I want is for you to help me get Felice back. She's not unhappy here. She's sick, and I sedate her, but no more than I sedate myself. And she's not unhappy here. Describing Felice in restaurants reminded me of another time in a restaurant with someone who reminded me of Felice, but in unexpected ways. He's an author, you see, pretty much a famous one, American. How we came to be together is a long story. Simply, I had enticed him with entertaining fan letters, and when he was in town, he called me. He ended up not liking me much, I think, because my letters were more entertaining than I was in the flesh. I was overstoned and stiff and timid. But let me say that, though he struck one as brilliant, His earthiness showed his brilliance way off, shoved his earthiness way off against the wall. He was so earthy, so helplessly yearning, that watching him was like watching a 50-pound tongue sewn to a 50-pound eyeball, sewn to a 50-pound stiff penis, sewn to a 50-pound raw heart. He was a gourmet, and since he relished good taste with his master tongue, in a rage he flung the wine list across the restaurant because it had no wine of a certain region in France, which he claimed was the only wine that went with what we were eating, a Provençal chowder. The thing that struck me was, like my Felice, his little tantrum was somehow on behalf of everyone. I suggest a deal. Let's put it all on the table. Here, you go to wherever she is, walking on her, and see if she's happy. If she's happy, you're doing better than me, so keep her. Keep going. If she's unhappy, send her home because you're doing no better than me, and probably worse. And I love her. You people don't, and she knew that in the first 2 seconds. I really should tell you someday what Felice has taught me about Mount Appetite. Do you actually want honesty? You did challenge me. So do you want to know what I want? Are you capable of telling me what you want? Why is the onus on me? So hey, let's get to know each other. Isn't it funny how we, I mean the universal we, but that's still you and me, isn't it? Don't talk about the thing we crave most of all. I'm talking about that thing we talk around. That thing in the background when we nudge, nudge, wink, wink, when we advertise cars or underwear or anything at all. That thing your Freud said runs the whole enchilada. It's the mountain's main deity, but we only circumambulate and dare not speak its name. Isn't it funny that guys like you and me, will get into shoelace arcanery of the New York Yankees, or what color fly catches what spring trout, or the finest print on mutual funds, but nobody... Picture all these buddies sitting in a big room with us, Doctor. Nobody in the room has a clue what anyone else thinks about the very best thing. Not a clue. What sounds each other make having one? What brings one on quickest for you or for me? Who likes to delay it a bit? You understand my point? Wine experts go on about after nose and fruit and length. Why don't we all of us being experts at our own orgasms after all, have coffee break conversations about what's way more important to us than wine. I'll start. In the name of Mount Appetite, I'm going to tell all you guys all about my favorite thing. I am 42 years old and, having just seconds ago figured out my computer's calculator, I can tell you that I've had between 5,000 and 7,000. Because my wife died 10 years ago and I don't get out much, way more than half I've enjoyed by myself. How were they, you ask? Well, all right, I'll tell you. 1 out of 10 was exceptional. Maybe exquisite, or maybe even heavenly, applies here. These words used accurately by me for probably the first time. At the other end of the scale, 1 out of 10 is so dull I might as well not have had it at all. I don't know how crude you are, doctor, or if scatology was part of your curriculum, but maybe you've heard the expression, a good shit's better than a bad fuck. I consider this to be very much a medical observation, since it describes not just the quantity, but the quality of nerves firing, a kind of elite rather than steerage synapse. And those bottom 10%ers, don't you agree that they have the soul of an unbuttered potato? Since you ask, if I could attach a color to orgasm, it would be orange, a taste, sweet and sour. Sometimes in the middle of one, I'll crank my head to the left. I don't know why, just feels right. Sometimes I feel one throb like candy in my ankles. They say you lose consciousness during the peak second, but I stayed with it, and I disagree. It's a thoughtless state, but clear-eyed as sky. I submit that it's a doorway. A sneeze is similar, maybe identical. I'll coin this. A good sneeze is better than a bad fuck, too. And I submit that someone who took this up religiously could, after some years of study, shoot right out of themselves with an orgasm or a hearty sneeze. That's my suspicion. Where they go is anybody's guess. I had a point, and I believe it's that I have no idea if Felice has ever had an orgasm. It's something I'll never ask her. Maybe Rose could have. This might be my one failure as a father. I submit in all seriousness that it might help Felice an awful lot if she masturbated an awful lot. Why shouldn't I want my daughter to enjoy the best in life? At least it would take the edge off. With Felice, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? That edge, doctor? you psychology types ever consider orgasm as therapy, or is that simply too weird for you, or too close to home? Your first year anatomy exam should have been a gargantuan circle jerk, hundreds of you, pencils clattering to the floor, profs urging you on, the last to come getting kicked out and forced into law. Yoo-hoo, doctor? Achoo!
Brilliant, thank you. So, what is it that grabs you in those couple of pages there?
I think the most disturbing image is the cranking the head to the left point. Like I every time I read that, I just kind of like, ugh. It just makes you go, a lot of it too, I think, has to do with the fact that he contradicts himself kind of constantly, and like we all do, right? So he'll say one thing and then sort of say the complete opposite later, and. Even though you'd almost think you should dislike him for that, it makes you believe him, makes you like him, makes you think, like, this guy's like us, this guy, we're in it with this guy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his kind of logic, if you think about it or reread the sentences, it's quite screwy. Like when he says, I suggest a deal, let's put it all on the table. Here, you go to wherever she is, walk in and see if she's happy. If she's happy, you're doing better than me. And he goes into this whole thing. But it's a sort of a weird kind of logic, because how would the doctor be able to tell whether she was happy anyway, and all of this, you know, this sort of stuff. It has a kind of a demented raving quality to it, and yet it's also incredibly true. I mean, all the stuff he's going on about how we talk about shoelace arcanery of New York Yankees, but we don't talk about our orgasms or our sex lives, essentially. We don't talk about our toilet lives. This is absolutely true, isn't it? We don't talk about being animals, which is what we are.
Yeah. Yeah, and we don't talk about, well, what he, like, mount appetite, basically, what he talks about. Those really deep desires that we have. We never do.
Yeah.
Very rarely with loved ones, maybe. But even then, it's all, like, that's what the whole book is about, not just this story. It's about people who are kind of consumed by that.
So, of course, the million-dollar question, which he sort of goes into a bit later, which we're going to read, but for you, what is mount appetite? Because mount appetite is also a metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a metaphor for want, I think. And I don't know. I mean, he says, when he describes mount appetite, that most people don't even know they're on it or know what it is that they're after and wouldn't even know if they got it. And it's only like this guy's... kind of constant reflection on mount appetite that allows him to even talk about mount appetite. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, where does Felice come into this?
She's right near the top. He says that, right? And she constantly tries to get to the top of mount appetite, to the peak, but is constantly denied. And he says that there's nothing worse than being denied getting to the top of mount appetite.
Yeah,
and that she's just denied constantly and constantly and constantly. And it's that he says that she. It's not that she. Because that. She, it's not that she just can't make a decision. It's that she wants the perfect. She's the perfect, whatever it is, and that because you know, when she's in a restaurant, if she's trying to choose between the French fries or the chicken strips, if she wants the perfect meal, whereas we all just settle, she can't settle, and that's his explanation for what's wrong with her.
Yeah, because, I mean, he says in the next few pages, again, in one of our abridged parts, he says, don't tell Felice this, but I find her pain completely typical. This is to say, in her pain, I see mine and everybody else's. Because, of course, that is what we're all doing, aren't we? We're all kind of worrying about whether we should have maybe gone for the, you know, the all-butter shortbread rather than the digestives. Yeah. I mean, I've brought both, but so you don't have to choose. But.
Yeah. And it's also like, so it's the idea that she, that because she always wants the best and she can't settle, it's the fact that he is also like, he wants the best too, but he doesn't want to settle for what's going to happen to her, right? He wants the best for her, but he's not aware that, or not at least savvy to that, even the prospect that the best for her might actually be to not be with him, even that if that is the answer.
But then here, this is where my kind of Daily Mail Melanie Phillips. I think Melanie Phillips. Is Melanie Phillips? Yeah. This is where my inner Melanie Phillips jumps out and sort of says, "But you know, but shouldn't he be letting her, or shouldn't maybe even the doctors be letting her work out her relationship to a desire rather than sedating her?"
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure she can. I think that's what the whole problem is. Is that she's too aware of her relationship to her desire and is unwilling to settle. And I don't know if the suggestion is that the cannabis tea allows her to just settle or not. I'm not sure if that's what it means. But he says sometimes he'll remove himself when he sees one of these tantrums coming on when she can't choose. He'll sometimes remove himself, hoping that by removing the audience, it'll allow her to just be her in the problem, and that doesn't even help.
Okay, well, let's read a little bit more. Maybe if we skip sort of slightly towards the end. So we're now just past the new year, January the 3rd.
Okay, so January 3rd. "You don't answer phone messages, and I need to talk. You say in Felice's, functioning well where she is, I don't buy for a second. I'm glad she's been placed in a family rather than an institution, but your words, functioning well, scare the hell out of me. That's lungs, doctor. That's digestion. That's table manners. You won't tell me what drugs you have wrong because apparently I've signed away my right to know. I'm desperate. The huge blind wheel of bureaucracy has rolled over me and left a brutal impression in the mud, and it's hardening around me. I'm going to get really honest now. I'm going to let myself get loud. I hope you'll at least respect me for it and not judge me lightly. I hope there's still some reason to be talking to you. Do you know Felice at all? Picture a huge mountain swarming with life. The mountain is invisible and can be seen only because of the swarm on it. Not just people, not just all the animals and insects, but all plant life too. Everything on it is moving. At the base, things move slowly and randomly. Plants here don't grow well and are prone to fading and death. People are dazed and barely aware of their surroundings. Their state is distraction. It's a refracted sleep. They nibble at things, and their eyes go from this to that. At Middle Mountain, things happen faster. There is a general energy and sense of purpose, even if it's automatic. People move more quickly because they have a destination, whether or not it's the right one. They grab for things with no doubt that this is the thing they want to grab. You can see it in their eyes. Plants do well here. They function well here, doctor. Think of fields of prairie grass. Think of people at their desks and in their cars. There are fewer people up where Felice is, not just because the top of a mountain has less room, but because it's a wild and windy place and you can't stay long. Plants are at an urgent peak of bloom a second before dying starts. People are at their tip-top height of passion. If they're having sex, they're almost at orgasm. Or they are slamming the last door in a divorce, or they are about to kill someone. They are at the verge of spiritual enlightenment. Big-eyed foxes an inch from catching the rabbit. Salmon quiver as they almost release their eggs. The top of Mount Appetite is the closest thing anyone can get to heaven. It's work to get there, and it's agony to be denied. Felice is denied many times a day. January 8th. Probably it's good you haven't returned my calls. Who knows what I'll say, and maybe there are some bridges I haven't burned yet, but I'll keep saying whatever I want. Mount Appetite is where I live. You live here too, only you have another name for it. You call it desire or something, but probably don't capitalize it, nor do you think of it as your home. I submit that you live in a state of desire at all times, even in your dreams. In Sanskrit, it's called dukkha, or constant dissatisfaction, which shows us a slightly different angle, a negative view of our home. I could go on and on about this mountain of ours because Felice has taught me about it for years and years, and I think of it constantly. But I'll talk about it only in ways that will help you understand Felice. Let me try to sum up her condition. She knows too much. She intuits a best. It's not just menu items or correct spelling or which halter top. It's what they represent. Perfection. Truth. Beauty. It's within her reach. Every second. She knows she can choose perfection at any time. She knows she should, because that's the main thrust of living on this mountain. It's like the background music here, but it plays in our spine and skull. Catholicism and its famous guilt got it right. you have to let should prod you heavenward at all times, or you are damned. Anyway, it makes us clamor up. Doctor, Felice can leap from the base of the mountain to the very top in 1 second, and it's as grotesque and startling as it's beautiful. We know this perfection, don't we? Come on, can't you sense it? Isn't it right around the corner? Isn't it where that bird just went? My poor little Felice can't let go of that bird. The rest of us give up easily. We settle for the partial and the half-true, for the crumbs and shadows. Felice? She gets a whiff of the perfect and she can't not follow. She wants it. She needs it. She can't not have it. She can't let go, can't let go, can't let go, and she's hanging off the mountain's highest cliff with her fingernails. Felice can't quite find the key. She knows no one else can give it to her because they don't quite have it either. I suffer her accusing looks. But she's so close. She's full with it. She's raw from it. All I've been able to do is hold her, hug her hard through her violent failures. Look at her face. Don't call me a deluded parent, because perfection is reflected in my daughter's face. It shines through her insane desire. You can see it coming off her like light, light that falls into my eyes as from a heaven almost here. She's so near the peak, foot, inch, millimeter, and she's grasping and she's falling and she's hitting the rocks again. You know what I do? I watch her. Watch her and love her with gratitude for what she's showing me. Love her for her sacrifice. Because in her agonies, I learned myself. I see I am no different, just slicker, more adept at pretending perfection away, pretending I am not in agony myself. To watch her is to understand the mystery of the Bible. She's simply doing what Jesus did. To love her for showing me the mountain while she falls away in agony again and again. It is love born of blood sadness, which we all know is the only kind of love. I wish I could watch you as you read this. I could tell where you are on this mountain, how close you are or are not to the top. And I could help you. We can help each other up, even by pestering. We can help each other off. Because, doctor, here's the trick. Here's what I've been on about since I sat down to give you my version. Here's what Felice has taught me, what she has shown me in the passion play she has performed. For hourly, for years, the irony is too big for words. Mount appetite is futility. Mount appetite is pettiness. Nothing is better than anything else. How can one thing be better than any other thing? How's blue better than yellow? It's impossible. All comparisons are odious. That's the first thing Felice teaches you. Felice can't choose what's best because there isn't one. In my reading, I have found that Seng San said it most accurately. To set what you like against what you dislike, this is the disease of the mind. It's not the degree of desire that is sick. The sickness is desire itself. You see this plain as day when Felice shows you the mountain, its whole height. It looms over you as the portrait of human ailment. I think Felice sees it too. I think it's her big secret from herself. To see this is to be off the mountain and be free of it, free of desire. It is wonderful to refuse to participate. It's almost like all along, she has been teasing me, saying, Dad, let me show you how stupid, how futile this struggle of ours is. I've been a dull student. Her mother was quicker to get it, I think. Then, poof, she was gone, though I doubt there was a connection. Felice has been teaching me all this, all along, inadvertently perhaps, but perhaps not. I don't know what puts a teacher in our path. Why tell you any of this? Maybe I still have some flicker of strategy, even though so far my sense of you is that you are a mid-mountain functionary, devoid of much passion at all. Let me try to explain another irony that's too big for words, because you probably didn't get this one either. I desperately desire Felice back so that she can show me again in her big cartoon way that to desire anything is missing the point. I need her to come back so I can stop wanting her to come back. I need her to stop my howling. I need her to come and take my heart in both fists and pop it. January 21st, last note to you. I don't know why I picked this up again, and I have even less idea why I include you, because you've given me nothing. Maybe I still want you to understand. I also want to tell you about hope and where I just found it. Maybe I'm still trying to help you up the mountain. We do need to reach the top before we can get off. I can honestly say I have no idea where my daughter and I are as you read this. I will send it when we arrive. Despite the restraining order, I have been going to see Felice at her new school. I come at recess to watch her from the parking lot. Usually, she just stands and studies the others, and this is saddening in the extreme. She already looks too tall for recess. Thankfully, this year is the last of it. Anyway, before this morning, I never stepped out from behind the vans and cars to let her see me. I can tell you've been giving her hard drugs. It was like she was seeing me through a filter. Please admit to yourself that they are nothing but the easiest route. Wherever we end up, I will no longer let this happen. There is Felice, standing a timid third of the way into the schoolyard. She is wearing a new wool Christmas coat that cost someone some money. That same someone had bent under pressure and allowed her to wear eyeliner. She is watching a circle of her peers, all acting cool in ways she can't, but she's getting more observant, and when she practices their little ways, sometimes she pulls it off. Cocking the hip, tossing the hair over the shoulder. Today, I almost don't want to interrupt her studies, but my first, smallest wave catches her attention. She sees me and instantly can't decide what to do. She looks back to her classmates, then over at a group of younger kids playing a bounce ball game. She glances at the school doors, behind which is a principal, or a phone, and the voice of someone like you she has been instructed to call should her father try to come get her. Then she looks back at me. She can't decide, and I hang by my nails from the mountain. In fact, this whole last month has been me hanging and breathing hard, but the thing is, Felice decided. Sometimes it's possible to see the truth and grab it, running.
Fabulous, thank you. So how do you read that all-important, as it always is, the all-important last couple of lines of that short story?
I read it as he's been planning to just try and force her to make a decision. He's been planning it, and he's been testing it. He's been putting himself almost to the point that he can get there, and he finally is able to do it here. And that's the desire. That's him, almost at the top. That's him as close to the top as he can get without her. And then that's him getting off the mountain, I guess, when she comes.
And when he says the thing is, Felice decided always to take that she, maybe for once in her life, actually does decide.
Yeah.
That's her decision. She decides to stay with her father, to be with her father.
Yeah, that's how I read it. And also because the clue is earlier too, is when he says, I can't tell you where, I have no idea where my daughter and I are as I read this.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, and that's when, yeah, he forced her to make a decision, and she's able to at that point.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fabulous and also kind of ironic way to end a story that is all about appetite. That's all about desire, desiring, and in some sort of quite, I was going to say neat way, but it's not neat entirely, but also maybe slightly neat. He actually gives the reader what the reader desires.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you could also argue, well, if this is a story about appetite, should he not, as lots of good short stories do, leave the reader desiring?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, there's no reason why you have to do that, why you have to leave them ambiguous. But also, as like the final story in a collection about exactly this, it seems fitting to throw back and to answer the entire collection as a whole to do that, I think. So I'm happy that it's this way.
Yeah. I'm happy as well.
Yeah. My girlfriend thought that she chose not to come with him, which I was confused by. But again, women.
I think that comment, you probably want that ended up more than the thing about the marijuana. It's a fantastic description, isn't it, of that mountain? What you know. It's just an incredible, what is that description? What is that mountain?
Well, it's sort of just crazy enough, right, to sound like something that someone thought up over years of, like, smoking dope and their take on some sort of spirituality. It is some sort of spirituality. I'm not sure which exactly. Sang Seng? I don't know who that is, but...
And yet it's not crazy.
No,
it's
not.
It has a real psychological and spiritual coherence to it, that whole description, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that is kind of what life is. Life is for all of us. So is his idea that where we're needing to be on the mountain is sort of, is it kind of about the middle way? I mean, how do you read, if there's a sort of a kind of a philosophy behind this, what is he saying?
We have to be off the mountain. That's what he's, that's the only way, because Mount Appetite is pettiness. Mount Appetite is where is it? Where does he say Mount Appetite is something? Mount Appetite is pettiness. Futility. Mount Appetite is futility. Mount Appetite is pettiness. And he says that the only way to get off the mountain is to get to the top and then not desire at all. So it is very...
Okay. Which is a very kind of classic sort of Buddhist idea, isn't it? That sense of, you know... kind of no desire, extinguishing desire. Or rather a kind of two-dimensional sort of sense of... I mean, I was curious to see that one of his stories was in Shambhala Sun, which actually is a Buddhist magazine. Is Biff Buddhist?
Yeah.
Is he a Buddhist practitioner?
Yeah.
So when he talks of dukkha and all of that sort of stuff, I mean, he kind of knows what he's talking
about.
And
so I assume that's what Mount Appetite is a take off of. I know next to nothing about Buddhism myself, but I'm assuming it's a takeoff of that spirituality.
Yeah. And yet, the description of being on the mountain and certainly being halfway up the mountain—that doesn't sound too bad. I mean, at least you're with desire, but you're kind of you're not letting it get the better of you.
Yeah, or you're at least not aware that it's getting the better of you, right?
Yeah.
People grab at things with certainty that that's what they want, even though they grab for things with no doubt that this is a thing that they want to grab. There's a general energy and sense of purpose, even if it's automatic. So it's like this automatic sense, like just like that's what I want, and grabbing it. It's almost animalistic, I guess, in a way. It's just like animal wants to eat, grab. You know, there's not like that sense of reflection, I guess, on it.
So what is off the mountain then? What does that mean to you, and is it even possible?
I do not know. It's not the degree of desire that is sick. The sickness is desire itself.
Yes.
You see this plain as day when Felice shows you the mountain, its whole height. It looms over you as the portrait of human ailment. To see this is to be off the mountain and be free of it, free of desire. It is wonderful to refuse to participate. It's almost like all along she's been teasing me, saying, "Dad, let me show you how stupid, how futile this struggle of ours is."
Mm. Is that the answer, though, to be free of desire, or to have some sort of understanding about it, some sort of reflectiveness? I mean, because essentially, that's what the fiction writer has, doesn't he or she? They have an understanding of desire, but they're not free of it, because if you were totally free of it, you wouldn't sit down and write, would you?
No, you wouldn't. But I think it is it's the answer within the story and within the spirituality the story is espousing, and then also within the book as a whole,